that Victor Hugo's writing is like an uncle who's trying to tell you a story, but keeps getting distracted by politics.
Welcome to Keep It Fictional, a weekly podcast for book lovers by book lovers. Build your to-be-read list with Sadie, Liz, Virginia, Fiona, and Corrine from the Port Moody Public Library. Warning, this podcast contains strong opinions and may cause an increase in your library holds list.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Keep It Fictional. I am your host, Fiona, and I am joined by my book friends, Virginia, Sadie, Corrine, and Al. And in this time of actors and writers strikes, we are going to be talking about television and movie read-alikes. So we are doing an if you like this, then read this episode. And before we get started, I would love to hear from my book friends about their watching tastes. What kind of TV show or movies do you like? And do you find that that lines up at all with what you like to read?
For the most part, mine do. I quite like watching fantasy and witchy kind of things, magical things, which I also love to read about. On a lesser kind of scale, I do also enjoy watching mysteries. They have to be like mystery light for me to be able to watch it. One of my favorite things to do whenever we go to my parents' house is we will always stay up late watching British Mysteries, and it is something that they have done for years, and it just always makes me think of them. And it's the only time I watch British Mysteries is when I'm at my parents' house, but I do quite enjoy watching those, and I have, thanks to Corrine, I feel like, have started reading a lot more mysteries. But as I said, the ones that I watch do have to be like mystery light. I can't do a ton of spooky stuff and murdery stuff in those ones just because I find it harder to watch than I do to read.
And what are you watching right now, Sadie?
I was actually just saying that the only the time that we have right now is we watch Jeopardy because that's all we have time to watch right now. Me and my husband are huge Jeopardy fans. It was a very, very hard time for me when Alex Trebek died. It was like super difficult because he was a wonderful, wonderful person. But we love Jeopardy. So we watch Jeopardy every single day and we record it. So if we miss it, then we go back and we watch it. The only time that we have not gone back and watched it is when Evie was really, really young and we had no time and we missed most of Matea Roach's run on Jeopardy, which was unfortunate. But we watch all of the Tournament of Champions. We watch all the Masters tournaments. We're quite into Jeopardy. We've also slowly been working through the second season of both Shadow and Bone and Only Murders in the Building, but much, much slower.
Going on our murder theme. So my reading taste and my watching taste do coincide. Unlike Sadie, I love a true crime documentary. I was born and raised on Unsolved Mysteries, and that theme song still like elicits a very strong emotional response in me. And I think Murder, She Wrote is the greatest scripted television of all time. I also don't mind a little romance, but in terms of my movie and book where it kind of diverges is I will read dramatic books about dramatic literary sad things, but I refuse to watch any sad movies at all. I'm not interested. My favorite movies and what I think are the greatest cinematic achievements of our time and generation are the Fast and Furious movies. I think Fast 10 is a masterpiece. And I don't know that I can kind of find that nitro feeling in literature.
I just think that Vin Diesel doesn't relate to literature. He can't.
Oh, Sadie, let me sit you down for this. Okay, so Vin Diesel, aka Mark Sinclair, is actually the biggest nerd to step foot on this planet. He's hugely into Tolkien. He has compared the next three Fast and Furious movies to like Lord of the Rings in terms of scope and epicness. And so he is deeply into sci-fi, deeply into fantasy literature. You would never know it by the Fast and Furious franchise, but that is where his heart truly lies. Big into comics as well.
That's what I'm saying. Like, could you really write a character with as much depth as Vin Diesel?
I mean, you wouldn't need a lot of dialogue because all he says in those movies is
I was going to say, I don't actually watch a lot of TV. I find it really difficult to concentrate. But when I do, I watch a lot of sci-fi. I'm a huge Doctor Who fan. It is my sort of comfort TV show. I also watch a bit of anime. So me and my roommate work our way through a lot of anime shows. And so right now we're watching Revolutionary Girl Utena, which is fantastic. Yeah.
Same thing. I don't really watch a lot of TV or movies. If you have to ask me, like, am I going to spend time reading? I'm going to spend time movies. Reading always wins. So I don't know. Like, I feel like I would probably tolerate more funny stuff when I'm watching a show than I would in a book. Like, I don't care for funny in a book, but I think I would be more likely, like, in terms of like diverging, but like still, like, if I had to pick, it would be all like the horror or science fiction. Like, it would be the same stuff that I would tend to watch. Right now, weirdly, I am watching a anime about a cat. My masterful cat is depressed again, or something like that, whatever the name is called. It's about this cat who has grown giant, like giant cat, who cooks for the lady that picked her up as a kid. And so she does all the cooking, she does all the cleaning. And she takes care of her owner the other way around. And the owner is very concerned because one of her boss at work said that, oh, I've seen your cat before. And she's like, what do you mean you've seen my cat? My cat is giant and it does cooking. So yeah, so that's where I am right now. So yeah.
That sounds very interesting. I've not heard of that and I will check it out. All right. I watch kind of as eclectically as I do read, but with a strong vein of historical fiction and definitely some like questionable like colonial content thrown in there. I do love a like costume drama, and then have like go like full the other side of like teen contemporary, anything gay pretty much is like just mirrors my reading content with my watching content. So let's talk about books now. Let's go to Virginia, I believe, said that you wouldn't mind going first.
Sure. So like I said, because it is so easy for me to pick a show because I don't have a lot of choices. And the only show that I really religiously follow season after season is The Great British Baking Show. So I don't know if reviewing a Paul Hollywood's bread book is going to cut it today. But there is a show that I did watch recently, and in fact, I stay up to binge watch it, which is not a thing for me. Staying up are very, very rare. To no surprise of everybody, the show that I actually stay up to watch is Yellow Jackets, also recommended to me by our dear colleague, Sydney. So Yellow Jackets, if you're not familiar with the show, is the story of a high school girls' soccer team who's on their way to a tournament when their plane crashed and they landed somewhere in Canada in the wilderness, and they have to figure out how to survive. And we know that they did survive because the show sort of have two timelines. One is the present time when the girls and some of them at least have grown up, now adults, dealing with the trauma of that plane crash and being haunted by their past. And then we see them as teenage girls doing what they can to stay alive while they are out in the wilderness. Now, there are many aspects of the show, I think, that appeal to people. First of all, the amazing acting. Like, very often when you watch a show where you have like sort of a younger and an older version of the same characters, they're just not believable. But in this show, absolutely the opposite. You can totally see how this person grows into this other person. And it's just amazing. It is not just this appearance thing, because like kudos to the people who did the casting, but also absolutely the hats off to all the actresses who must have spent so much time kind of studying one another to make sure they can capture those mannerisms, how they talk, how they walk, how they behave, all those little things. It is just amazing to watch. So watch it just for the acting. But also, I think another thing that appeals to people, of course, is sort of this Lord of the Fly-esque kind of survival story, but with an almost all-female cast and lots of representation. So that definitely appeals to a lot of people, because some of them did survive. There is sort of a bit of that sort of final girl kind of feeling to the story. Yellow Jacket is also a story about some very complicated female relationships, friendship, camaraderie, the toxic group dynamics. So there's a lot of that in there. And of course, the supernatural aspects, you know, is there something out there with the girls when they are out in the wilderness? Is it real? Is it in their imagination? Did they do what they did because they want to, or is someone else pulling the strings? And all of these questions are yet to be answered in the two seasons so far. Can't wait to find out. And of course, some people are drawn by the promise of cannibalism. I don't know who those people are. And the killer soundtrack, if you have a nostalgia for 90s music, and we're talking like Tori Amos, PJ Harvey, or like the newer rendition of Just a Girl by Florence and the Machine, this show has like the best songs, and they are perfect for all the scenes where the songs appear. So, so, so good. And you can feel your heart just pounding, just listening to that theme song, No Return, when it comes on. So to find a book for this episode, I was kind of looking for a book that covers all these aspects of the show. And there are many, many lists out there for reader likes. And out of all the books that they recommended, I think this book that I read for today has the most potential. It seems like it's got the feel that you get from Yellow Jackets. And the book that I have is The Grace Year by Kim Liggett. And this is a young adult dystopian novel set in a county where when the girls turn 16, they are sent out to the woods in sort of a fenced-off area, and that is where they are going to live for a year, and they call that the grace year. They're given food, they're given supplies, should be enough to last them for a year as long as they are sensible about it. And they live all by themselves for that 1 year. And after a year, when they come back, if they survive, then they can rejoin the community. Now, this ritual has been going on for years because the people in this county believes that girls are born with magic. And this magic is dangerous, specifically dangerous for all the men in the community, because bad things will happen if you just let these girls live among them when their magic is supposedly the most potent. So this magic is a temptation, is an evil thing, and the girls need to get rid of that themselves. Hence, they are sent out to fend for themselves in the woods, to learn to do whatever they can to purge themselves of this evil that is inside them, and to release this so-called magic back into the wild. And afterwards, they are welcome to come back and become the docile woman that the society needs them to be. The night before the girls get sent out, they hold a veiling ceremony. And on this night, the young men and all the widowers, all the eligible bachelors, they get to pick a girl to be their wife, and they will give the girls a veil. When they come back after the year, then they get married, and that is their life. Tierney is turning 16, and this is her grace year. She has been trying to find out more about what happened when they're out in the woods, but none of the women would talk. Her mother, her older sisters, they've all gone through it, but they won't say a word about it. They're not supposed to. That's okay. Tierney has it all figured out. Whatever it is that is out there, she's going to survive. She's going to come back alive. And she already knows what job she wants to do after she gets back. Because if you don't get a veil, you just get sent off to do a particular job. And she knows exactly what she wants to do. Because Tierney has no interest in becoming a wife. She has no interest in marriage. She has made it very clear to everybody. And she also doesn't make herself very agreeable. And, you know, so she thinks that like no one is going to give her a veil. And that is just fine for her. Except on the night of the veiling ceremony, someone did present a veil to her. And that someone is Michael. Michael is the son of the mayor. In a year's time, Michael's father is going to pass that job to him, and Michael will become the mayor. Michael is also Tierney's best friend. So she is furious because of all the people Michael should know how she feels and what she wants to do with her life. And she has absolutely no interest in becoming anybody's wife, including his. How dare he gives her a veil? And now Tierney is going into her grace year, not knowing what that is going to be like, but also has a target on her back because everyone thinks that Michael is going to give a veil to Kirsten. And Kirsten definitely expects one from Michael. So now she thinks that Tierney has taken something that is rightfully hers, and she is pissed. And she is not going to make life easy for Tierney once they are out there all by themselves. Now, doesn't that sound like a really good Yellow Jackets kind of setup, right? You got the wilderness survival thing. You got this all-girl cast. You got all the alliances, all the conflicts. And the magic that they supposed to have, like, is it real? Like, how's that going to play out? Is it just a lie that is made up? Or do they really have magic? So, Yellow Jacket fans, if you are thinking about picking this book up, I have a suggestion for you. So, this book is divided into four parts. It's autumn, winter, spring, and summer. So, like, the year, the grace year, until the girls get to come back to live with their families again. I'm going to suggest that you read up to about page 167, which is the end of the first part, which is autumn. And if you really have to, go until about 200, but that's about it, okay? And once you reach that page 167, I like to suggest that you put down the book and then use your imagination to fill in the rest of the book yourself. Channel your inner Shauna, your inner Natalie, your inner Misty, your inner Taisha, your inner Van, your inner Lottie, and think of all your favorite Yellow Jacket characters and write the book, write the ending yourself. Because this book, at that 200 page or so, take a turn. And I was actually listening to this as an audiobook, and I like rip my earbuds out and I almost throw it across the room because it makes me so angry. I don't understand why a book that is supposedly a Handmaid's Tale for the young adult audience can turn into this thing. I don't know why the author will choose to do this to this story. And I can't tell you what it is, but I just don't get it. I was so, so angry at this book. And because I can't really rage listen, I have to rage read the book. So I borrowed the paperback copy just so that I can flip the pages with like anger and like try to get through it because I have to read this for the episode. Just stop. I don't understand. I don't understand. This is supposed to be a book about power that you have and taking down the patriarchy and burning it all down. That's what I thought the book is, but it is not. And it is super, super annoying. So yeah, 167, that's about all you should really read. And I believe in all of you that you can think of a better book than what happened here. As I mentioned earlier, there are many, many lists out there for read-alikes for the show. Many of the suggestions, I think, kind of focus on one aspect or the show that you enjoy. So if you're here sort of more for the survival story, I think Small Game by Blair Braverman, which I haven't read, but it came up a lot. If you're into the female friendship aspect, Bunny by Mona Awad is the one that keep coming up. If you're interested in the dietary needs for the girls in the Yellow Jackets, come to the library. I have book recommendations for you. And maybe really just go watch Yellow Jackets again because nothing can replace it. It's just not the same. So yeah, that is my book for you today.
Thank you so much for that candid review, Virginia. It's very exciting coming from you. And as someone who has not ever seen Yellow Jackets, I'm tempted to read the book just to find out what M. Night Shyamalan foolishness seems to be happening in this reveal. Oh, you're looking at me like that because I've not seen Yellow Jackets. Is that? All right. Oh, boy. Let's just keep it dark. We'll go to Corinne and you can tell us about all the murder.
How did you know? So my television series is definitely a murder series, but it is actually a show that Zadie and I have in common. And Only Murders in the Building gives me the same feeling as reading a Seishi Yokomizo book, who is like a Japanese golden age crime writer. When you open it up, you just give a big sigh of contentment because you know you're in good hands. A is going to lead to B, is going to lead to C, and it's all going to be okay. So creators Steve Martin and John Hoffman take you in their very capable hands and just kind of swaddle you in character actors and like New Yorkishness and like theater jokes and like all your favorite actors, and here's a nice little mystery for you to enjoy. Don't worry too much about it. Don't worry. And at the end, you just drift off into a happy sleep. And that's Only Murders in the Building, despite the fact that it has one kind of grisly murder in the first season and then more in the second. But anyways, it is, on the surface of it, a kind of critique, funny poke at true crime podcasting, where three strangers who live in this beautiful building called the Arconia become obsessed with a true crime podcast that brings them together, despite them being very different people. We have Steve Martin, who is a kind of washed up television actor, but he's Steve Martin. So you just, like, he's so avuncular. You just kind of want to just like awkwardly hug him and pat him on the head. And it's like, it's okay. You can make an omelet for me. I hate eggs, but I, for you, Steve Martin, I would. You have the indomitable Martin Short, who is playing a theater director whose last, oh, I don't know, 20 productions have ended in total disaster / maybe someone drowned, who is kind of struggling to make rent because no one will hire him to do his great directing because horses died. And then you also have Selena Gomez, who this is the first thing I've ever seen her in, and she's kind of delightful, according to Wikipedia, because I was like, what is her job? It's apartment renovator, which I don't think is a real job. Anyways, they have all been brought together into this beautiful New York apartment called the Arconia, which is essentially a murderer's row of character actors. Each one of them a beautiful, beautiful prototype played to perfection by actors like Devine Joy Randolph, Amy Ryan. There's a Tina Fey. Shirley MacLaine makes an appearance in the second season, and I cried. I don't know. And Jane Lynch is there. And then Nathan Lane. Oh, Nathan Lane. Anyways, so there are two seasons so far. The first season centers around a person in the building, Tim Kono, who seemingly has a bit of a history with Selena Gomez, who they get into an elevator with as they go up. They notice him kind of playing with his phone, having intense phone calls. And then that night, the building is evacuated. And when they sneak back into the building, because they're true crime fanatics and we're all nosy, they find that Tim is dead of an apparent suicide. However, they do not believe this. They remember him talking on the phone, making plans, as well as they find a package for Tim, which contains an engagement ring. So it is very, as Sadie said, a mystery, a light mystery. It doesn't focus too much on the goriness of it. It's really about all these characters and all these fantastic actors. And then, of course, the podcast that these three strangers start, which turns into a phenomenon. So a lot of the read-alikes for this particular series kind of focus on that idea of the podcast as a convention, as the podcast as kind of like a social phenomenon, and specifically about true crime podcasts. So the book that I chose for this off of a list of recommended books is definitely a lot darker than the series and just lacks a certain je ne sais Steve Martin. So have you listened to Reconsidered, the Chuck Berman Murder? This is a new true crime podcast by the improbably named Poppy Parnell that chronicles the seemingly open and shut case of Chuck Berman, who is a mild-mannered professor who was killed in his own home by the 17-year-old boy next door. Now, this boy was troubled. He was known to be into drugs and, as he describes in the book, satanic music. And he had recently discovered that his mother was having an affair with Chuck Berman. Now, there wasn't a lot of evidence at the scene. However, there was an eyewitness, Berman's young daughter, Lainey, who clearly saw and testified that she saw Warren Cave, teenage misfit, shoot her father at point blank range. On the basis of this eyewitness testimony, Warren was locked up and has been in jail for the last 12 years. However, Poppy Parnell has a feeling. She has been approached by Warren's mother, Melanie, who has always said that Warren is innocent. As Poppy interviews Warren, she also gets the feeling that this young man maybe is not as guilty as he seems. And so she decides to investigate. And of course, if you are a true crime fanatic / have some mild journalism training, what do? You create a hit podcast. And that is Reconsidered. Have you heard it? Now, Josie Borden has. She has a seemingly normal life in New York. She works in a bookstore. She has a really hot New Zealand boyfriend who's also a humanitarian. And she spends most of her time in their lovely little neighborhood. Until one night, she gets a strange call. A muffled voice says, "I miss you too." She thinks that this is her boyfriend who's working in the Dominican Republic at the time, and maybe they just have a bad connection. But the voice and the words haunt her. And that is not the only thing that is dogging her steps. When she is at the overpriced farmer's market, she overhears two teenagers talking. "Have you heard about the Chuck Berman case?" She learns about the podcast and she can't not listen. Because for her, the story is not just a story. Chuck Berman, mild-mannered professor who was having an affair with next-door neighbor, was her father. The mother, who seemingly driven mad by grief and joined a cult, is her mother, who she hasn't seen in 10 years. And the star eyewitness to the murder is Lainey, her twin sister, who she hasn't had any contact with in 10 years since a terrible betrayal broke them apart. Now, Josie feels like she has buried this past. She's changed her last name from Berman to Borden, which honestly, as a victim of a crime, seems like a bad call. Her boyfriend doesn't know anything about her history. In fact, she has said that both of her parents died in a car accident and she is an only child. She has shuttered her old life into a box and pushed it down until this podcast forces it all to the surface. Soon after the podcast begins to get very popular, she gets a call from her aunt that says that her mother has committed suicide and that she is begging her to come home. Josie is forced to confront her past, her family's past, and the questions that Poppy, who is a straight-up psychopath, is asking about the case. Is it as open and shut as it seems? Can she trust her sister's word about what happened that night? Or did something else happen? Are You Sleeping by Kathleen Barber is described in the front as a novel for the podcast generation, which I don't know what that means. Yeah, whatever that is what it is. It's very serial. It's very, 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 very serial about someone comes in and just starts disrupting everyone's life. Poppy Parnell in the book, The Podcaster, is kind of a ruthless psychopath in the way that sometimes I feel like the main characters of Only Murderers in the Building kind of are. They're not great people, except for Steve Martin, who is flawless and has never done a wrong thing in his life. Except write that one terrible book. Oh, it was so bad. But anyways, that's not his fault. I would say that this is going to sound really bad. As I was flipping through it, I was like, this really feels like a Reese Witherspoon book club pitch. Not in a bad way. It's just the ones that I have read that have been thrillers. They have a very particular vibe. And I was like, feels like that. And lo and behold, when I looked on the Wikipedia page, it has absolutely been chosen to be made into a TV series by Reese Witherspoon's production company. So I feel like I've got a really good pulse on Reese Witherspoon. Like, I feel like we're really like connecting on that level. The book definitely clips along. It's kind of interspersed with transcripts from the podcast, as well as the social media aspect of it, which I found really funny because it really did encapsulate how people on the internet work and that most of them are idiots and leaving very stupid comments. And it had like a very light critique of like the true crime fandom in the same way that I feel like Only Murders in the Building is kind of poking fun. And it's like, hey, this is a real thing that happens to real people. And maybe don't camp out in front of people's houses. That's ghoulish, which I agree with. So I would definitely say, like, if you like Reese Witherspoon books, and if you kind of enjoy like a light thriller that's not too dark, I argue it should have been more sinister. You could definitely pick this up. If you are looking for something kind of on the same lines that kind of does like a podcast investigation interspersed with an actual narrative, I'd actually recommend two YA books, which I thought were fantastic and have done it better than I think any other genre. Sadie by Courtney Summers, I think, is a fantastic. Sadie is nodding her head, and not just because the book is named after her, is fantastic, as well as Holly Jackson's Good Girl's Guide to Murder, which also does a really, really good job of this. I think I've read the first three and I thought they were absolutely splendid. So if you're part of the podcast generation, then yeah, you can definitely pick up this book if you're just looking for a very light thriller. And you do think that podcasters are a bit ruthless, and you thought Tina Fey's character in the second season maybe was over the top? No, that's fine. You could pick up Are You Sleeping by Kathleen Barber.
Thank you, Corinne. Going back to the characters in Only Murders in the Building, I was amazed by Selena Gomez. Before that, I could not tell her from another pop star. I was like, which one is that? And then I'm like, you're like a cute, like, I don't know, person that I feel like I would want to like talk to. I don't know. I was just surprised. That was my reflection on Only Murders in the Building. That's what I got out of it. I like Selena Gomez.
See, I've been a huge Wizards of Waverly Place fan when I was younger. So I have followed Selena Gomez like from her OG roots as a witch. Yeah.
I love that. That's very Sadie. Yeah.
She really does hold her own against like two, I'm going to say, very forceful performers in Steve Martin, and like Martin Short is like chewing scenery, right, left and center. No bit of that building goes unnod. But she really holds her own and gives a really like great performance.
Well, I think that she's been able to take herself as an actor and get away from like her Disney Channel roots in a very big way. And also the only show where Martin Short didn't just drive me up the wall.
True words were never said. Martin Short's just a lot.
I know. He's a lot. He is a lot as a performer. And I think it worked in that show.
All right. With that, why don't we go to Al?
All right. So today I am going to be talking about a book that I'm going to compare to Stranger Things. Now, Stranger Things, huge Netflix phenomenon, set in the 80s in a small town called Hawkins, Indiana, about a group of kids who find themselves wrapped up in a story about human experimentation, about a strange other dimension called the Upside Down, and have to work together with some of the adults in the town to figure out what's going on, to stop the monsters, and to bring peace back to the little town. The book that I've got today is a pretty new one. It's Camp Damascus by Chuck Tingle. In this book, we follow Rose Darling, who is a pretty normal young woman by the standards of her small town, Neverton. She's a member of the Kingdom of the Pine, a Christian sect that dominates the town, and she loves Jesus and her family. She's curious about science and memorizes interesting facts to tell people at social events. Neverton is a small town, not particularly notable, except for one thing. It hosts the nearby Camp Damascus, the Kingdom of the Pine's ex-gay conversion camp, which boasts a stunning 100% success rate. Not that Rose would know much about that, since she's not gay. Of course, she does get strange feelings in the pit of her stomach when she looks at one of the girls in her social circle, but that's just, she just really wants to be friends with her, right? But things start to get strange when Rose starts to notice a strange woman who seems to be following her around. She's got lank, dark hair and fingers that are too long, and a red polo shirt with a name tag affixed that says Patched, which is the name of a demon. Rose starts feeling cold whenever she thinks too much about girls and coughs up flies at dinner with her family. Something strange is going on in Neverton, and Rose is determined to get to the bottom of it. When her search takes her to breaking into her therapist's safe, Rose finds out that she's more connected to Camp Damascus than she realized, and their celebrated 100% success rate might have something sinister behind it. And that's when things start to get weird. So Camp Damascus is the first traditionally published novel by celebrated online author Chuck Tingle, known more for his quirky romance and erotica novels and short stories than he is for horror. I'd only had a little bit of exposure to him before this, partly in memes, partly in a romance book club that I'm in. We read the Harry Potter pastiche Trans Wizard Harriet Porber and the Bad Boy Paracerolophus, which was sweet, but ultimately not my jam. This one, however, I actually really enjoyed. I'll be excited to see what Chuck Tingle comes up with next and see what else he publishes more traditionally. The horror in this book is relatively light, as such things go, and most of the creeping fear comes more from the people around Rose rather than the demonic presence and their attempts at keeping her sheltered and unaware of what's really going on. The characterization of Rose is strong, and while it's never outright stated in the book, the writing makes it clear that she's neurodivergent, and the author has stated in interviews that, like him, she is autistic. This is a fun, sincere novel with a lot of heart, and as Chuck Tingle would say, by the end, it proves love. And anyone who watched Stranger Things and enjoyed it, especially the strong character work and the elements of institutional horror, but wished it was a little more gay, will probably enjoy Camp Damascus.
Sold. I am absolutely sold on that. That sounds awesome, Al. Thank you for bringing that. Okay, we are going to take a diversion, and we are going to go to pre-film and television times and talk about what our favorite classic novel is.
So, like, obviously Jane Austen for life. I think Persuasion is the most perfect novel ever written. Pride and Prejudice is fine, but that's like a young child fantasy. Persuasion is like where it's at when you're like old and bitter and tired and looking back on all the mistakes of your life. And you're like, God, I could use a nap and maybe a handsome boat captain who's loaded now. Yeah, so I definitely recommend Persuasion or Jane Eyre. Jane Eyre is my other like classic.
Well, I think that most of my book friends know that I don't read a lot of classic literature. So I'm going to have to say Oliver Twist, mainly because I've read it. I read it kind of as a cop-out when I was in high school because I had to read a classic novel and I had just performed in the musical Oliver a few years before that. So I figured I could just skate by on my knowledge of the musical. I did read it, but I skimmed it. But that I feel like has to be my answer because I don't have anything else.
And speaking of musicals, I'm a big musical fan. And because of this, I tackled several years back The Brick, Les Misérables. It is a fantastic novel. The way I like to describe it is that Victor Hugo's writing is like an uncle who's trying to tell you a story, but keeps getting distracted by politics and wants to go off on tangents about things like the Battle of Waterloo or the sewers of Paris or the relevance of monastic life in modern times. And by modern times, I mean the times that the book is being written. It's weirdly wholesome. It's a lot of fun. And it's just a beautifully written book. It's one of my favorite classic novels.
I've been trying to get through it since high school. I haven't yet.
Maybe try an audiobook, Sadie.
I think that's the way to do it. I questioned we'll do it for one of our upcoming ones, but I know that Gabriel already talked about it in length. So,
weirdly, mine, it's going to be Wuthering Heights. Don't ask why. I know. Yeah. What the heck? Well, because back in the days when I actually read the, which is like high school days, like that's when you're very, yeah, that was what it was. So I'm just going to stick with that. I know. I don't know what happened there.
I'm not surprised. I feel like that's like the goth book. Not that, I mean, emotionally goth book. It's like, you know.
He kills so many dogs.
All right. Way to bring it down.
What's yours, Fiona?
Well, I think everybody here knows that my favorite book, I say my favorite book of all time is Dracula. So probably Dracula, but I'm currently reading Little Women, like for the first time since I was a child. And it's delightful. Like even, you know, all of the adaptations can't do it justice. I just love the little slice of life. Clean. I don't know. I like it. It's good. Also, Anne of Green Gables. You know, just those ones that give you that happy childhood feeling.
If you want that feeling to be destroyed or like augmented, I would definitely recommend any biography of Louisa May Alcott because it is fascinating. Her family on the whole of it is absolutely bonkers. But you kind of see how she mined her own life and was writing within the conventions of that particular style and why she was writing it and for whom she was writing it. And the fact that it was all based off of her sisters. Yeah. Like Little Women is arguably a beautiful children's book. I do love it on that level. And then I like the meta of it. Yeah. Louisa May Alcott is a fascinating character.
That is my next stop. I'm glad you brought that up because I found the same thing with L.M. Montgomery and Little House on the Prairies. When you're like, oh, I would like to deconstruct this a little bit. And then you're like learning about the author and you're like, yeah, I wouldn't have been ready for that when I was a child. But I'm glad that I can bring this context into it because, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. All right. Thank you for sharing your favorite classics. I think we still have Sadie who is going to share her show to book recommendation.
All right, we're going to go complete other side of things here. And I'm going to preface this by saying that I do not watch a lot of reality television. I watch Great British Bake Off. I watch The Amazing Race and I watch a lot of Food Network. But when it comes to like Bachelor, Big Brother, Real Housewives, that kind of reality, like super dramatic drama, kind of gossipy reality shows, I don't tend to enjoy them. Now, the exception to this, which a lot of my book friends know, is 90 Day Fiancé. And to be completely honest, I don't actually know how we started watching 90 Day Fiancé. I feel like maybe it was just something that was on one Sunday night. It always used to be Sundays. And me and Tyler just had it on. And we got into it and we got drawn into it a lot. So we started watching it quite regularly. We watched it very, very almost religiously for quite a few years. And we would keep up to date on not only 90 Day Fiancé, but Before the 90 Days, 90 Day Fiancé the Other Way, 90 Day Fiancé Happily Ever After? Question mark. And even so far as to watch the spinoff series Darcy and Stacey about the absolutely horrible twin sisters who just can't find love in the US. And so they have to go and find love in other parts of the world. And it just never works for them. Just doesn't work. And I mean, so yeah, so those who are not familiar with 90 Day Fiancé and its 17 spinoff series, 17 of them. Yeah, the five that I mentioned are nothing compared to the 17 spinoff series. The general idea comes from a visa process in the United States. So if someone from the States has a partner who is not from the States and they are wanting to move that person to the States, they can apply for a K-1 visa or a spousal visa. This is a real thing. This is not made up. This is a real process. And once they are approved for this visa and their partner has moved to the US, they have 90 days to get married. If they do not get married within that 90 days, their partner is no longer allowed in the country. They will be deported and sadness ensues. So, according to TLC, this means the perfect place for a show or 17 of them. So the various versions of this show just basically follow a variety of couples as they navigate the process of the K-1 visa, but more importantly, as they navigate the drama that ensues when you are bringing somebody over to the country that you live in and you have never really met them. You don't know them that well. Maybe you met on vacation. Maybe you met online. Maybe you, I don't know all of the variety of different situations where these people meet, but they have to get married in 90 days and they don't know each other. They don't know all of these things that couples should know before you get married. And so, yes, it is very dramatic. It is very high stakes. It is very ridiculous. It has you asking the question repeatedly, is this person getting scammed? It occasionally says that, yes, this person is getting scammed. It makes you feel unbelievably amazing about any friendship or relationship that you have ever had in your entire life, because it is, no matter what, better than most of these couples. It also makes you feel real good about the person that you are, even if you're not a great person, because you will, no matter what, be better than a lot of the people on this show. So it is a lot. We have distanced ourselves more just because, as I said, there's 17 of them. And they not only, when you record it, you have the lead up to the show, which has its own episode. You have the show, you have the pillow talk of the show, which is other people from the old episodes of the show watching the show and giving commentary. And then you have the follow-up episode to the show, which is like, here's a recap of what happened on the show. So each episode comes with four episodes and it's very overwhelming. So we don't watch it as much anymore. And I'm a little bit sad that I don't know the couples anymore. But anyways, when I was thinking about a show for this episode, I decided that I was in the mood for romance. And I mean, what says romance more than 90 Day Fiancé? So I went in search of a book that was similar to 90 Day Fiancé. Now, the book that I found is The Kiss Quotient by Helen Huang. And this book follows Stella Lane. Stella is a very well-off, very successful econometrician living in Palo Alto. And our book starts with Stella while she is out for lunch with her parents. And her mother informs her that she would like grandchildren. Now, her mom knows that Stella does not do well with surprises, so she is telling her this so that Stella can start to plan out what exactly this means for her. However, 30-year-old Stella already knows exactly what this means. It means crying babies. It means uncontrollable environments. It means dating. It means relationships. And it means sex. And just thinking about dating causes Stella to break out in a cold sweat because Stella is not great with people. Stella likes numbers and algorithms and data. She can study, she can predict, she can determine patterns. That's where her strengths lie, and that's where she's happiest. She likes her routines. She knows that if she has to break one, it causes her quite a bit of anxiety. And Stella does not like dating, and Stella definitely does not like sex. So she makes her excuses. She rushes back to the safety and comfort of her office. However, she can't stop thinking about what her mother has asked of her. She knows that as a successful 30-year-old woman, dating shouldn't be a daunting thing. But the few dates that she has been on in the last few years have been absolute disasters, and she's fairly certain that it's her fault. And this is because Stella is autistic, and she knows that her autism makes her any social interaction she has very, very difficult. She knows that she acts strangely and comes across as weird. Or she asks blunt questions and comes across as rude. Or she's not able to enjoy the physical intimacy that comes with a relationship and she comes across as cold. And so Stella has come to dread the idea of dating and relationships. Now, while sitting in her office, mulling all of this over, Stella is interrupted by her cocky, in-your-face, and very self-centered colleague, Philip. After some rather inappropriate comments that I feel like sexual harassment is written all over, Philip tells Stella that if she's ever going to get a boyfriend, then she needs to get better at the more physical aspects of dating. And to do this, she needs to practice. This gives Stella an idea. So now we go to Michael Larson. Michael Larson is just like his father. He knows this in his heart. And as much as he absolutely loathes his father, he can't change that fact. Ever since his father walked out on him, his mother, and his sisters, Michael has just been waiting for the moment that he finally turns into the horrible con artist that he knows he's going to become. However, until that happens, Michael has other things on his mind and other problems to deal with. Because Michael's mother has cancer, and the bills just keep piling up. And Michael needs some way to pay them. So, unknown to everyone he loves, every Friday night, Michael works as an escort. Every week, Michael meets up with a different woman, and every weekend, Michael works through the emotions that follow these interactions at the martial arts gym with his cousins, Quan and Kai. Now, when Michael meets Stella, he assumes that she's just like any other of his clients. However, as Stella explains the proposal she has for him, he's really not sure what to think anymore. Stella would like to hire him, but not just for the night, for a prolonged period of time to teach her about physical intimacy so that she can be successful on dates, find a boyfriend, and one day have kids as her mother has asked. Michael has a very, very strong no repeat customer rule. And so he right off the bat says, no, definitely not. However, after Stella seems so convinced that this is the way that is going to fix all of her problems and asks him for another escort recommendation, Michael knows that she will probably just be taken advantage of and not treated properly by his colleagues. And so he reluctantly agrees to 3 sessions with the promise that Stella will not get obsessed with him. So over the next few weeks, Stella and Michael start to get more comfortable with each other. They both find out that, lo and behold, they actually enjoy each other's company. However, Stella knows that if she tells Michael about her autism, everything would change. And he won't look at her in the same way, just like everybody else does. And Michael knows that since he's just like his father, he can never actually be with someone like Stella because he's just going to hurt her in the end. So after a disastrous night out dancing, Stella decides that it's not actually sex that she needs practice at. It is the whole relationship that she needs practice at. So she offers Michael a huge amount of money to become her practice boyfriend, thus entering Corrine's favorite fake dating trope. Now, Michael needs this money. He knows he needs this money, but he also knows that if he takes this money, he is going to be that much closer to becoming his father. However, he eventually changes his mind when Stella runs into him at the dry cleaners shop and tailor shop that his mother runs. And Michael's mom invites Stella over for dinner. Their fake relationship has begun. I absolutely love this book. I did not expect to love this book. I didn't know what to think about it, but I absolutely loved it. I read it faster than I have read any book this year. I think I finished it in 3 days, which for me right now is a huge accomplishment. It follows a very typical kind of rom-com formula, but you get the added character development, the added diversity, which is really, really great. Stella and Michael are both just like such endearing characters that you just want the best for them. You also want them to stop lying to each other because you know that the second they stop lying to each other, it's all going to be okay. The author, Helen Haw, actually herself diagnosed with autism later in her life when her daughter was going in for an assessment for autism and she learned that she was as well. And so I think that she's able to provide such an authentic and sensitive look at someone who thrives with autism and what that means for them on a daily basis. I think the book really addresses the stigmas that often accompany autism and other neurodivergence. And it has a cast of characters who very actively push back against those stigmas, which I think is just really great. Looking at it as a comparison to 90 Day Fiancé, I can see the similarities. I think that if you're wanting like the romance aspect, the little bit of drama, then it fits the bill. However, every single person, except one in this book, are so much more wonderful than anybody on 90 Day Fiancé that I'm not sure if it was a perfect fit in that sense. I will give a warning that this book is extremely sexually explicit as well. So if you're looking for something that's a little bit more PG, this is not the book for you. If you're looking for some other kind of 90 Day Fiancé read-alikes, if you're wanting something that has that more international element to it, that 90 Day Fiancé has, kind of these two people from different countries, The Statistical Probability of Love at First Sight by Jennifer E. Smith, Playing with Matches by Hannah Orenstein, How to Ruin Your Boyfriend's Reputation by Simone Eccles, and Alyssa Cole's A Princess in Theory, I think would all be really good fits for that. I haven't read any of them, but they kept coming up on those lists as well. So I would definitely recommend The Kiss Quotient by Helen Huang. I think it's a wonderful romance, whether or not it fully relates to 90 Day Fiancé. I think if you want a steamy, awesome, fun romance, this is the fit.
It's so funny that you chose that book of hers because I believe her second book is literally the plot of like 90 Day Fiancé.
Is it actually?
Yeah, it is. Where the mom's like, oh, son, you need to get a lady.
Oh, for Kai, right?
Yeah, you need to get a lady. So yes. She brings one over. And yeah, and I was like, oh, okay. I love that you chose this book because on the surface of it, the premise is insane. It's a lot to take in outside of like the realm of fan fiction where you're like, I'll suspend my disbelief. You're like, oh, no, this is happening in the real world. But it is, as you very succinctly put, it is so sweet and heartfelt, and it's love to see. It's amazing to see like neurodivergent characters in romance in particular. And I think it's like peak romance book for me.
And I think it was just so great because you have this kind of supporting cast of characters, and Stella is always very worried about how they're going to respond to her autism, but then they're just so supportive, and it's just not a thing, which I think is really great. Like it just kind of is, it is what it is. And it's just not an issue for any of them. And the second book, as you said, it follows Kai, who is Michael's cousin, who is also autistic. And so it kind of continues on with that same theme, which I think is great.
Thank you so much, Sadie. Fun to explore both that side of your watching and reading. Always fun to hear a new side of somebody. So, all right, I've got the last spot here. And as ever, when I choose the topic, I always really, really struggle with it. There are a lot of shows that I love, and I really wanted to find a read-alike for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel or for A League of Their Own. And I just found that, like, everything I found, it would kind of cross over on like two major parts, but I wanted to get three. Like, I wanted to get, like, you know, historical, funny, and another thing where it was just like, these are like tangentially similar and not really get the feel. So I ended up reading, like, I don't know, I read three books, and then I like started like 10 books, and then ended up going back with a book that I really love that I read a long time ago. So my read-alike is for one of my favorite shows that is still coming out right now, Never Have I Ever, which is a show created by Mindy Kaling, who I find her humor hilarious. The Mindy Show, like, I watched that kind of religiously for a little while. It had a lot of seasons, and it kind of, like, petered out for me. But, like, there's just, like, her humor just really, really works for me. And this show is, like, very loosely based on her own teenagehood and experience as a second-generation American of Indian descent. And it stars, her name's a bit difficult to pronounce, Maitri Ramakrishnan, who is just fabulous. I can't wait to see what else she does. But she plays Davy, who's the central character. I'm a 15-year-old, yes, and a Canadian. She is so, like, she's not the kind of character that I would normally like. She's kind of impulsive. No, very impulsive, but she's goofy and hilarious, and you're really, really voting for her. You really want her to do well, even though she's extremely weird and makes bad decisions. So the show actually kind of opens up with one of her bad decisions. She has recently lost her father, and she's dealing with that grief. When she starts to come out of that grief, she decides she wants to, like, change her social standing, and that the best way to do that is to lose her virginity to her crush, who is sort of like the most popular boy in school, Paxton Yoshida Hall, who's played by Darren Barnett, who has since played some other smoldering love interests. And so Davy's approach is just to just show up at his house and be like, hey, dude, let's have sex. And then from there, comedy ensues. We get to know Paxton a lot better. We get to know his sister, who is just such a great character. Paxton, they really kind of, like, unpack this whole, like, popular jock dude through his relationship with Davy. Davy also has another crush or slash frenemy, Ben Gross, who's like this rich white dude, coddled kid. And it's always this will they, won't they love triangle. There's also great secondary characters. She has two friends, Fabiola, who is struggling coming out as gay, and I can't remember the other friend's name, but she's dealing with sort of an absentee mother. And it's got endearing characters, and it's hilarious. And for me, that's just like a win-win situation of just all of these, seeing Davy get into these scrapes that are just, like, situationally, like, comedy gold. So I reach back to a book that was written in 2002 that I think has a lot of similarities, but is very clearly written in a different era. So when this came out, it was kind of a YA phenomenon. And it is Born Confused by Tanuja Desai Hidier. And I absolutely fell in love with this book upon reading it. I did read it, like, more recently. So, you know, it's been around for 20 years. And I know it made a big splash when it came out. But it, in a lot of ways, it holds up. I do have some caveats, but for the most part, it holds up really well. So this book is about Dimple. She's also a high schooler, and she's also a second generation of Indian descent. She's a little more withdrawn than Davy is as a character. She's artistic. She loves photography. That's her passion. And, well, her parents are supportive. They don't really get it. And there's a lot of funny jokes about around, like, them just not understanding the whole photography thing, and her auntie's talking about how she's going into the darkening room, is what they call her, like, dark room, and they're like, why does she want to get darker? Just all this situational wordplay and just comedy gold, like, really hit my type of comedy. she has a best friend, Gwyn, who is white, and they've been kind of two peas in a pod since they were little. And Gwyn is like this superstar. She's beautiful. She's charismatic. And everywhere they go, everybody notices Gwyn. And then she's kind of the like the side character. And Gwyn also has, she has absentee parents, and they're rich. So they kind of, they think that that's enough, that they can, you know, they'll just leave her money and she'll order her own pizza and they'll be back next week kind of thing. So Gwyn finds a family in Dimple's family, but Dimple starts to feel like it's really like, you know, kind of crowding her out. Gwyn has everything. She's beautiful. Why does she have to come and take Dimple's parents away from her, be the center of attention here? This kind of like mounts when a boy comes into the picture. This is Karsh. He is the son of Dimple's parents' longtime friend. Sort of immediately, arranged marriage is like on the table as a possibility when they meet Karsh, and they're like, wow, this guy is great. Maybe we can, this is an old friend. Maybe we can set up an arranged marriage for Dimple. And Dimple's like, hell no, I don't want to do that. And then she kind of like, after she's already said no, she meets Karsh and is like, oh yeah, he's pretty cool. He DJs. I don't know. That's a big part of the plot. But then of course, Gwyn gets in the way and she's like, well, if you don't want him, I'm going to go after him. And there's this big, like, frustrating love triangle, but I really appreciate it's very nuanced in a lot of ways, and kind of uses this like love triangle and relationship between Dimple and Gwyn to talk about appropriation and where to draw the line, and for Dimple about how to assert herself and stand up for herself and find allies. And again, it had a lot of the same things that I really liked about Frankly in Love, which I talked about recently, just really like giving good characters, good writing and interaction, but then also having sort of like a more nuanced social justice underneath. And with this being written 20 years ago, a lot of it is a little less in your face in that it doesn't have other books as much to draw from and build on. So I think that it doesn't go as far. And I also want to just point out that there was something that I found pretty triggering. There's a trans character who sort of gets dropped in the end, and the language used to talk about them is not the language that we would use today, and they feel very much like a plot device of like, I will go talk to this wise person and learn a bunch, which is kind of like a pet peeve of mine. So I loved it. Like, I thought this might be my favorite book ever, and then kind of got to that point and was like, oh, that ruined it for me. But I still recommend it. And especially like kind of just knowing that that is coming, or avoiding it if that's not something that you want to have to deal with. But it's just an absolutely delightful book that I think, like Never Have I Ever, draws you in with great characters and great comedy. And then you find yourself sort of like getting interested and invested in these like love triangles and like other things that you maybe didn't come there for, but were like, okay, I'm into it. Yeah, just like absolutely, absolutely delightful. And she did write a sequel to that. I know it didn't get as good reviews. I haven't read it yet, but I am still planning to read that, as well as to follow every single season of Never Have I Ever as it comes out. I'm really hoping that they just got through, I think, season 3, I want to say, and Davey just finished high school. And I'm really hoping that we will get to see college Davey, because I can't wait to see all of the stupid mistakes that she makes when she is away from her mother and away from her Kamala, who's her like live-in cousin, who kind of is like a guiding force for her. And also just to see what happens with all of her other friends, and whether she could ever make it work with Ben Gross or Paxton. So thank you all so much for joining us for this episode about television and movie read-alikes. I think we all did TV, so we can call it television read-alikes. Yeah, we hope to see you next time.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please tell a fellow book lover about it. You can find a list of all the books we discussed in our show notes. Join us next week for another fun book chat. Until then, keep it fictional.